No. Okay, so we're on. Welcome back. Today we're going to be picking up from where we left off last week. Last week we spoke about the status of the Avos, the status of the forefathers before the Torah was given, vis-a-vis their degree or level of mitzvah observance. And what we came out with last week was that there seems to be this general consensus that the Avos, the forefathers, while they did fulfill many mitzvos many times, it was usually voluntary. And as such, based on the Gemara in Kiddushin that says, Gadol mitzuvah ve'oseh mimish einu mitzuvah ve'oseh, the greater is somebody who does a mitzvah because they're commanded than if they're not commanded and they do it voluntarily, we seem to say that the avos's, the saliency or the impact of their mitzvah observance was in a certain way less than our reward that we get for fulfilling the mitzvahs because we were commanded while they were not. And we explained both in the name of Rav Lichtenstein and the name of the Lubavitcher Rebbe and as well as others that the reason why Gadol mitzvah va'osa is greater, being obligated to perform a mitzvah is greater than merely volunteering to do so, is because then the relationship is not a one-sided relationship between humanity and God, but rather it goes both ways. And that allows us to transcend the limitations of our own physical beings. And in a sense, we are acting as agents of God and not just acting as agents of ourselves trying to do something nice for God. And so what we left off with is that although the Avos were very great people, we only truly became the Jewish people and the impact of our mitzvos only reached their full potential after the Torah was given at Har Sinai. And so what we left off with the question is that, so if that's the case, if the Avos are not really part of the quote-unquote Jewish people in the way that we are today, and moreover, if their mitzvos, the impact of their mitzvos are not as great as ours are today, then while they may have been very great people, why do we continuously evoke them, both in terms of ascribing merit and in terms of Jewish identity? As great as the Avos were, there were other great people other than them at that time, such as Noach or Shem or Aver. All of those people were very righteous people, and yet we don't say that. Hashem should answer us in the merit of Shem and in the merit of Aver. And yet we do for Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And so clearly they are a very important part of what makes up the Jewish people, even though the Jewish nation started much after them and they're technically not really part of it. And so that's really what I want to speak about and learn with you today. Essentially, what did the Avos contribute to the Jewish people if their only impact was limited to before Matan Torah? So I'm going to share the screen now with the source sheet for those that want to look on. Just as a reminder, if you could keep yourselves muted for the duration of the shiur, if you want to share something, a question or a comment, please feel free to use the chat function. And afterwards, you can also unmute yourselves and share any comments or questions using the voice. So the title for today's shiur is Die Like a Man Like Your Brother Did, The Legacy of Shepherds from Scotland, Ireland, and Israel. And we're going to start in a very odd place at first glance really does not have much to do with our question, but as we'll see, I really think it does. It's a New York Times article from 1889, October 8th. The title of the article is The Harlan County Feud, all the result of a drunken quarrel, a faction war that has cost many lives and still disgraces the state of Kentucky. So Harland is a city or a small town in southeastern Kentucky, in Appalachia region. I think it's called the Cumberland Gap, if I'm not mistaken. There's a number of very small hamlets there, and Harlan is one of them. The article was too long for me to include in its totality, but if you just want to take a look at the opening paragraph, It discusses this feud that had been going on for several years between the Howard and Turner families that started because some people were drunk and got into a fight at a poker game. And over time, over the next few years, there were at least 25 dead sporadically. And they actually appealed to the governor to send in troops, and they didn't want to because they were too afraid. And it just continued to be this full-out feud for many, many years. And what many historians and sociologists have observed is that that area, the Cumberland Gap in southeastern Kentucky, was filled with, I think it was close to 1,000 murder indictments from the 1870s to 1900. Given that the entire population was no more than 15,000 at the time, that's a huge percentage of deaths that's really doesn't have any other parallel throughout the entire United States at the time. And so what many historians have tried to understand is what was so unique about that small region that unfortunately resulted in so, so many deaths. And as we'll see later on, it seemed to be a cultural difference. I'm just going to scroll down so you can see a description of the account. It's a map of Kentucky. Harlan is with the Green Star on the southeastern area of the state. I'll read you a description of part of the feud. So everyone started shooting. Will Turner showed his courage, if not his common sense, by attempting to rush through the front door of the courthouse. Interestingly, the courthouse was the showdown area where they were fighting. He was hit before he reached it, got up and retreated, firing as he went, but he was hit again. He got up and with the help of others, staggered up the street to the Turner home, where his mother came out and helped him onto the porch. He had been hit in the stomach and was screaming with pain. "Stop that," his mother snapped. "Die like a man like your brother," little Bob, who had already been killed, did. Will stopped screaming and died. And it's an incredible, tragic account. But this conversation between the mother and her dying son really highlights that this seems to have been a very unique cultural phenomenon. Just to hammer it a little bit further, there's another story in a nearby town where there was this notorious person that was just always involved in feuds. His name was, the county's name was Breathitt County, and because of all the murders, it was actually known as Bloody Breathitt. And they had a trial where someone was accused of murder as part of a feud, and the defendant's father, who is described as a man of about 50, with a huge handlebar whisker, mustache, and two immense pistols. He walked up to the judge and grabbed his gavel. The feudist rapped the bench and announced, "Court's over and everybody can go home. We're not going to have any court here this term, folks." The red-faced judge hastily acquiesced in this extraordinary order and promptly left town. When the court convened at the next term, the court and sheriff were bolstered by 60 militiamen, but by then the defendant was not available for trial. He had been slain from ambush. And so this county or this region in Kentucky had this unprecedented amount of murders that seems to have been related to some inbred culture that facilitated this phenomenon. And so we're going to hopefully explain the source of that later on towards the end of the class, but I just ask you to keep this in mind for now. So let's go back to the Jewish people. In source number 3, in Sefer Shmos in Parshas Yisrael, right before the Jewish people are going to accept the Torah, Hashem tells Moshe to talk to the Jewish people and essentially encourage them to accept the Torah and become God's chosen people. And what's interesting is that God gives sort of two different descriptions, connected but different, about what the Jewish people will become if they accept the Torah. So in source number 3, at the bottom of page 2, in Pasuk Hey, verse 5, Hashem says, "Va'ata im shamoa tishmu bekoli," if you listen to my voice, "ushimartem es brisi," and you keep my covenant, "v'yisem li segula mikol ha'amim ki li kol ha'aretz," you shall be to me a treasure out of all people, for mine is the entire earth. That's one description. God says that you will be the most treasured of nations. Now, what's the implication of that? The implication is that God treasures all nations, and the Jewish people will be his favorite. And that's, in fact, how the Sefarno, one of the medieval commentaries, explains. If you look in source number 4, the Sefarno on that pasuk, he says, V'yisem li segula mikol ha'amim, you will be the most treasured of nations, afal pisha kol ha'minha enosha yakaretz li mikol yeser ha'nimtzaim, even though all of humanity is more beloved by me than other creation, other aspects or elements of creation, Ka'amram zichrona levracha, as our sages taught in Pirkei Avos, Chaviv Adam shenivra b'tzelem, that humanity in general, not just the Jewish people, but humanity in general is cherished and beloved by God because humanity was created in God's image. Mikol makom, nevertheless, what God is telling the Jewish people, atem tiyu li segula mikulam, you will be the most treasured of all of them. So Pasuk Hey creates this image that all of humanity is special, and the Jewish people will be even more special. And so it seems to be a almost quantitative difference. All of humanity reached point A, and the Jewish people will reach point B, but they're on the same wavelength. Now let's see Pasuk Vav. In Pasuk Vav, God says, Va'atem tiyu li mamleches kohanim v'goy kadosh, and you shall be to me a kingdom of princes and a holy nation. Eilah hadvarim asher tedaber al b'nei Yisrael. These are the words that you should speak to the b'nei Yisrael. And so over here, God is saying you will be a special and unique holy nation, and he does not compare them to the rest of the Jewish, to the rest of the world, to the rest of humanity. And so it seems that the Jewish people will almost be a category of creation unto themselves, a completely different wavelength than the rest of humanity, if you will. And if we look in source number 5, on the top of page 3, the Kuzari says something to that effect. The Kuzari was written by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, one of the giants of Jewish Spain in, I believe, the 1300s, if I'm not mistaken. And he wrote a book called The Kuzari, sort of a historical fiction account of the Khazar kingdom in northern Middle East area, on the border of Europe and Asia. And he uses that as sort of the springboard to talk about elements of Judaism. And one of the themes that he develops is that the Jewish people are a unique creation unto themselves. The way sort of the medieval philosophers conceptualized creation is that there are 4 individual levels of creation. There's domain, inanimate objects, someach, something that sprouts or is alive, like vegetation. Chai, something that is considered to be alive, like animals, and then medaber, humanity, which has the ability to speak. And so what the Kuzari develops is that with the onset of Matan Torah, with the giving of the Torah, there was actually a 5th category or level of creation, and that is Yehudi, or the Jewish people, which he describes as being unique because of their relationship with God. All of those previous 4 categories distinguish themselves by something. So the tzomeach, for example, is different than the domeim. The plant is different than an inanimate object because it has the ability to grow. Chai, an animal, is unique compared to other tzomeach, other things that grow, because it is ambulatory. It can walk. It has other life functions as well. And then a medaber, humanity, is unique from all other animals because they have the ability to speak. And then the Jewish people, the Kuzari says, are unique. Why? Because of the inyan eloki, because of this very unique connection to God that the Jewish people uniquely have. And he says this, he alludes to this in source number 5. He says, Ad shebo b'nei Yaakov kulam segula v'leiv nivdalim mibnei adam b'inyanim miyuchadim elokiyim samim osam ki'ilu heim min acher melachuti. So the sons of Jacob were distinguished from other people by godly qualities, which made them, so to speak, an angelic caste. Mivakshim kulam ma'alas hanivuah v'rubam magiyim aleh. Each of them being permeated with some divine essence or a connection to God that enabled them to achieve prophecy. And that's why predominantly Jews were prophets and not non-Jews. There were seven non-Jewish prophets, but the rest of the prophets throughout history were Jewish prophets. And so what the Kuzari is saying is that the Jewish people, when they were given the Torah and developed this unique connection with God, were elevated to a completely different wavelength of creation than the rest of humanity. And so some say that this is a dispute between the Kabbalistic philosophers and the more rationalist philosophers. So the Sepharno and others say that that essentially the Jewish people are not qualitatively unique from the rest of humanity. We're all people. It's just God chose us to be the most beloved, and therefore we are an Or LaGoyim, we are a light unto other nations. As opposed to the Kuzari or other Mekubalim, other mystics that say, no, that the Jewish people are inherently separate from the rest of humanity. It is a qualitative difference, and they are a completely different category of creation. But what others have suggested is that both are true. There are actually two elements to the uniqueness of the Jewish people. In some respects, it is merely a quantitative difference. We are an Or LaGoyim. And in other respects, we are actually qualitatively different. And what many have suggested is that this is reflected in these two psukim that we said, back in source number 3, that God told the Jewish people two things. You will be the most treasured of all nations. Essentially, you will be an Or LaGoyim, a light unto them. And then secondly, you will be a Mamleches Kohanim V'Goy Kadosh, a kingdom of priests and a holy nation that's completely separate. And so perhaps one can argue that that is the inherent tension that the Jewish people have had throughout their history so far, sort of balancing both of those two, not contradictory, but those two very different roles and trying to balance them out. And this is not merely a philosophical distinction. It actually has a very important halachic relevance. If we look in source number 6, this is an excerpt from a sefer called the Chidushe HaGranat. The Granat, it's short for Hagon, Rev Naftali Trupp. That's his picture that you can see by source number 6 on the bottom of page 3. Rev Naftali Trupp was appointed in the pre-war era in Europe by the Chafetz Chaim to be the Rosh Yeshiva in Raden. And he published a sefer of many of his shiurim, many of his talks and classes on the mesechtos, on the tractates that the yeshiva learned. So there's a famous sugya, there is a famous topic in the Gemara in Kisubos, which deals with the topic called Ger Katan, or the conversion of a minor. Now, normally a conversion of an adult is you get circumcised, you go into the mikvah, you come out, you're a Jew. A katan, a minor, has several different halachos, mainly owing to the fact that because he or she is not a legal adult, they are not considered to be mature enough to make the decision to join the Jewish people. And so there's a lot of different halachos about the conversion of a child than the conversion of an adult. So we're going to learn a little bit of that topic and see how it connects to what we've been just speaking about. Just one disclaimer. A lot of the opinions, or some of the opinions that Reb Naftali Trupp is going to be dealing with, are opinions in the Gemara, but ones that we might not necessarily follow halacha lemaisa practically nowadays. So, just to put that out there, I'm assuming none of you are actively involved in a conversion case of a minor right now, or none of you are officiating on a beis din involving the conversion of a minor. But just to put that out there, that one should not paskin off of what I'm going to say right now, because it's very possible that we don't agree with these opinions. So in source number 6, the Granat says, Nechleku b'gemara, there is a dispute in the Gemara, be'akum ve'eved haba al bas Yisrael, with a non-Jew or a non-Jewish slave that comes upon, probably the case in the Gemara was that it was a rape case, but essentially has a child with a Jewish woman. Im havlad kosher o mamzer, if the child that is produced from that union is considered kosher or a mamzer, Now, just to explain those terms, we talked earlier what a mamzer is a few weeks ago. A mamzer is a child born out of certain illicit relationships. And even though the child is Jewish, they're very limited in who they're allowed to marry. They're only allowed to marry another mamzer or a couple other categories of Jewish people, but they're not really allowed to marry into the vast majority of the Jewish people. So the Gemara says that a child born from a non-Jewish man and a Jewish woman, is the child considered to be Jewish and just a mamzer, or is it considered to be kosher in that it is able to marry into other into the mainstream Jewish community as well? Vishitas haTosfos, and the opinion of Tosfos is the lemanda amar havlad kosher, that according to the opinion that the child produced is kosher, humishum de azlinan basar didei, dehainu ha'akum o ha'eved. The reason why the child is kosher is because we actually follow the status of the father. Havlad goy kosher. And so what emerges if you follow the status of the father is that the child is a non-Jew. But if the child converts, they're allowed to marry any Jew they want because there's no concept of a mamzer by a non-Jew. Ulefizeh, and according to this line of reasoning, Havlad Sorach Gerus, this child produced from this union, needs to convert. Now, this is problematic from another Gemara that we shall see in source number 7. In source number 7, the Gemara says, Amar Rav Ada Bar Ava. So Rav Ada Bar Ava said, Leviya Sheyolda Bina, a Levite woman who gives birth to a son, Pater Mehei Slaim. That child does not have the mitzvah of Pidyon HaBen. Normally a firstborn son born to a regular Yisrael family, the firstborn son has to undergo Pidyon HaBen, where you give 5 silver coins to a Kohen. And so it says that if the child is born from a Levite woman, that child is exempt. So then the Gemara wants to clarify what that case is. Miman, so who was the father in this case? Ilema di aber me Kohen umi Levi. If you want to say that the father of the child is a Kohen or a Levi, my Iria Levia, then why did we say that the case is by a Levite woman? Afilu Yisraelis Nami. Even if the woman was a Yisrael, the child would also be exempt because we follow the father's status. So Ella di aber mi Yisrael. It must be that we're talking about where the husband was, where the father was a regular Yisrael. But then the Gemara says that can't be either because l'mishpachosam l'veisavosam. Because personal status is patrilineal. Tribal status is patrilineal. And therefore, if the father is Yisrael, then the child should be obligated in Pidyon HaBen. So therefore, Amar Rav Papa, the case is di'aber me'oved kochavim. That the case is that the child was born from a union between a non-Jewish father and a Levite woman. So if that's the case, then whose status do we seem to follow in this case? We seem to follow the woman's status. Because the woman is a Levi, and therefore, because the woman is a Levi, therefore the child is exempt. But based off of source number 6, according to Tosfos, it seems to be that we follow the father's status. So if that's the case, there seems to be a contradiction. What is the difference between the case in source number 6, where a non-Jewish man and a Jewish woman have a child and the child needs to convert, and yet in source number 7 we say in that very case, the child is actually exempt from Pidyon HaBen because his mother was a Levi? So that's one question that the Granat, the Rav Naftali Trapp, asked. One more case. There's one more case which he also asked a related question to. In source number 8, there's another Gemara in Yevamos. This happens often in cases of conversion, where if a woman converts and she's pregnant, what is the status of the children? So the Gemara in Yevamos says, Shnei achim te'umim gerim v'chein mishuchrarim. So let's say you have 2 twins. that were born before their mother and they converted. So therefore, after they convert, they are all considered to be unrelated. A gershon, a geyer, a convert that joins the Jewish people, kekatan shenola dami, the Gemara says, is compared to be a, like a child that was born anew, and they have no familial relationships vis-a-vis halacha. There's a famous question whether a convert is obligated to, in kibbut of aim, to their non-Jewish parents, or if we want to make the case even starker, what happens if a whole family converts? Are the children obligated in kibbut of aim? But we're not speaking about that. We're just talking about what is the personal status of these twins. So the Gemara says that if they were born before they and their mother converted, then they are considered to be completely unrelated. The ein chayavin mishum eishes ach, and therefore they are allowed to marry their siblings, their brother's wife, if the brother passes away. Normally, unless one is fulfilling the mitzvah of yibum, one is not allowed to marry the wife of a close relative, such as a brother, even if that relative passes away. So what this Gemara is saying is that if they were born before they were converted, then they are allowed to, since they're not related. But then there's a bit of a more complicated case, which is what the Granat wants to talk about. Haisa horasan shelo b'kdusha, v'leidasan b'kdusha. If they were conceived when their mother had not converted, but she converted and then gave birth, then it says, chayavin mishum eishes ach. Then the Gemara says that they are prohibited from marrying their brother's, they are forbidden from marrying their brother's wife, ostensibly saying that they are related. However, the Gemara says, lo choltzin, they do not perform chalitza. You are not allowed to perform the mitzvah of chalitza or yibum. The mitzvah of chalitza and yibum is that if one's brother dies without having children, there's a mitzvah for one of the other brothers to marry the widow. And only the brother is allowed to do that. And so what the Gemara says is that they're not allowed to marry their brother's wife in terms of chalitza, but they're also not allowed to marry her in general. So there seems to be this sort of in-between case where you're partially Jewish and yet you're not partially Jewish. So that is another question that the Granat wants to understand. The Granat wants to understand what is the status of these twins, of these children, if they were conceived when their mother was not a Jew and they were born when their mother was a Jew. The Gemara seems to imply that there's this limbo status of being partially Jewish and not partially Jewish. If we look in source number 9, the Chazon Ish, one of the great rabbis in Eretz Yisrael in the 1930s, 1940s, and 1950s, he quotes an answer which he does not agree with or he believes doesn't make sense. He says, Ra'isi b'pritoar. I saw in a sefer called Pritoar b'shem Hagon Milisa from the Gon, the genius of Lisa, Shida'ato, whose opinion is Shetzarach Gerus, that these children require conversion. Ella shala achar hagerus lo mikri ger. But once they convert, they're not actually called a ger. They're not actually called a convert. Ella Yisrael, but they're considered to be Jews from birth. B'chol zezar ma'od. And the Chazon Ish says, well, that's very strange. That doesn't make any sense. You can't have it both ways. How could you be a convert and a Jew from birth? And yet, that's what the Pritoar and the Gon Milisa seem to be trying to say in all of these cases, that the status of these children are that they need to convert, but once they convert, they're considered to be Jews from birth. And so how does that make sense? And if we look in source number 10, the Beis Yishai, Rav Shlomo Fischer, who we spoke about several weeks ago, he answers based on those two levels of the uniqueness of the Jewish people. Rav Shlomo Fischer elaborated on something that the Granat answered. He phrased it slightly differently, and that's why I wrote down his language. And he says, the Inyan Yahadus Kolel Beis Dvarim. that the concept of Judaism includes two different things. The first one is geza, is lineage. The second is das. The second is religion. So geza, lineage, dahainu shem mishpachas Yisrael, belonging to a Jewish family, essentially an ethnic national identity, tuluya be'em. That is contingent upon the mother. The ilu das, but religion, doesn't mean religion in the abstract, but he means dehainu chiyuv Torah mitzvos, but the degree of one's obligation in Torah and mitzvos, to toloi ba'av, that is contingent on the father. So if you're a Kohen, if your father is a Kohen, then you're a Kohen. If your mother is not a Kohen, you're Jewish, but you're not a Kohen. Vihine, kabbalos geira. So then, if that's the case, if there are two aspects of Judaism, what exactly does conversion include? So he says the concept of geiros is kabbalas Torah mitzvos. It's only the second element. It's only the acceptance of Torah and mitzvos, dahainu kabbalas das Yisrael, the accepting of the Jewish religion. Ve'ilu geza, but ethnic lineage, dahainu mishpacha, family connection, lo shayich lekabel klal. You can't accept that. Ella, however, shegzeiros hakosavu. But God and the Torah decreed, the Gershon is Gayer v'kibel alav das Yisrael, that a convert that accepts upon themselves the second element of Jewish religion, na'aseh bidei shemayim kekatan shenolad, actually changes their lineage as well. Even though that's from a rationalist or social or you know sociological standpoint or a genetic standpoint, that's an impossibility. The uniqueness of conversion is that halachically it transforms one's affiliation, one's ethnic affiliation as well. Mihu, however, he qualifies that. Misha imo Yisrael ve'aviv goy. So let's go back to our first case where there's a Jewish woman and a non-Jewish father. Nimtza nechshav mimishpachas Yisrael. So if that's the case, if we follow this distinction, then that first part of geza, of ethnic lineage, that person has. That person is considered to be part of the Jewish family. Ve'eino chayav b'mitzvos, but because the father is not obligated in mitzvos, neither is the child imloshen is gayer, until they convert. So what the Granat and what the Beis Yishai, what Rav Shlomo Fischer are answering, is that there are two elements of what make the Jewish people unique. They're nation, their concept of a nation, their ethnic nationalistic identity, as well as their religious identity. And those come from two different sources. The ethnic identity comes from the mother's side, it's matrilineal, and the degree of mitzvah observance is patrilineal. That's why Shvatim, which tribe you belong to, is patrilineal. Because based on your tribe, if you're a Kohen or a Levi or a Yisrael, there are different obligations that you have. So now this makes sense. We can now explain and answer the questions that we had. So if we go back to the contradiction or the ostensible contradiction between the two cases of a Jewish woman who has a child with a non-Jewish husband, we said that they need to convert, and yet we follow the mother's status in terms of being exempt from being from Pidyon HaBen. Why? Because in terms of having a Jewish family, they are considered to be part of the Jewish family. It's just that they're not obligated in mitzvos. So the child needs to convert. But in terms of belonging to a Jewish family, they are. And if the father is not Jewish, then what Jewish family do they belong to? Well, they belong to the mother's Jewish family, which is a Levi. And therefore, they are exempt from Pidyon HaBen. They do not have to pay the 5 coins to the Kohen. Similarly, the second question about the twins that were conceived when the mother had not converted and they were born after the mother converted, because they were conceived while she was not Jewish, therefore they are not obligated in mitzvos, and yet because they were born from a Jewish woman, because they were given birth to when the mother was a Jew, therefore they are considered to be part of a Jewish family, but they are not obligated in Jewish mitzvos. And therefore, they are considered to be Jews, but still need to convert. they are considered to be obligated to convert, but once they are, they're not called converts. They're called Jews from birth. Since they really were Jews from birth, what changed was not their ethnic affiliation, but rather just their mitzvah, their degree of mitzvah obligation. So this was a very interesting halachic discussion. But what I want to take out of it is that there are two aspects of Jewish identity. One is mitzvah observance, and the other is being part of the Jewish nation, being part of the Jewish family. And so in terms of being part of a nation, being part of a family, in that regard, we are in Or LaGoyim. We are on the same wavelength as the rest of the world. We're just different. You have the French nation, you have the British nation, you have an American nation, and there is a Jewish nation. That's one aspect where we are connected and similar to the Goyim, but just slightly different. There's a second element of religion, which we got from Har Sinai, a certain connection to God, the dialectic connection between commander and commandee, which we spoke about last week of mitzvos, and that is something that is completely unique amongst the Jewish people and makes us qualitatively different. So how does that connect to the Avos? How does that connect to the forefathers? Well, if you remember from 2 weeks ago, we spoke about how Avram Avinu and how others were allowed to keep Shabbos. And the answer that we gave is that even though non-Jews are forbidden to keep Shabbos, because the Avos, because Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov and their families had entered into a middle stage of a covenant with God, therefore their keeping the Shabbos was not considered to be violating any other covenant, because they were part of God's covenant, they just weren't obligated in particular mitzvahs. And the language of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, Rav Soloveitchik's grandfather, in source number 11, in the bolded part, he says, this is source number 11 on page number 5, he says, "D'bechefza hayu aleihem shem Yisrael," that the Jewish people, in essence, were called Jews, ella de'bedin, but halachically, hayadin ben Noach, vis-a-vis their das, their religion, they were like non-Jews. And what Reb Chaim, based on what we've just said, Reb Chaim is distinguishing between those two levels of Jewish uniqueness. He's postulating that from the time of Avraham Avinu, we had already achieved one of those two. We had already achieved the Geza part of Kedushas Yisrael, the national ethnic lineage component of the holiness of the Jewish people. They were considered to be named Jews, but we just didn't have the Kedusha of mitzvos. We did not have the mitzvah obligation yet. And so if we wanted to explore what the Avos, what Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Leah, and all of their families, what they contributed to the Jewish people, they contributed to the first aspect. The reason why we revere them, or the reason, or what they contributed, was they contributed Geza. They contributed the national ethnic identity of being Jewish. And that's just not in name only, but it actually has ramifications for us to this very day. If you look in source number 12, there's a Gemara in Yevamos. It was popularized by a song by Avram Fried about 10 years ago. He says, "Shlosha simanim yesh b'umazu." There are three signs of this nation, of identifying a Jew. You know, there are often these comedic sketches of trying to spot the Jew, if you will. And so the Gemara is saying, if you want to know how to identify a Jew, it says there are three indicators. There are three character traits that Jews have. Rachmanim, they are merciful. V'haybayshanim, they're modest, they're not brazen. V'gomle chasadim, and they do kindness. And the Gemara says, how do we know they were kind? Dichsiv, as the Pasuk says, Lemana asher yitzave es banav ve'es beiso. This is the Pasuk that we talked about many weeks ago. The source that Avraham Avinu and his children kept the mitzvos. And Hashem is telling or talking aloud and saying, I know that Avraham instructs his children and household to follow in his ways. So we up until now had been saying, what are his ways? The mitzvos of God. And what this Gemara is saying, it wasn't only the mitzvos, but what he really transmitted to his kids was the midah of chesed. Essentially, what the avos contributed to the Jewish people that persists until this day are certain inbred midos, certain inbred character traits that we have a great predilection for. If you look in source 13, the top of page 6, Rav Tzadok HaKohen says this explicitly. Rav Tzadok HaKohen says, Hashlosh midos sheyesh b'Yisrael, Rachmanim b'Yishanim gomlei chasadim, that the three character traits of the Jewish people, Heim mushrashim b'libam mishlosh ha'avos, are rooted in the hearts of the avos, which we got from them. And so if we would pause right now, we have about 15, 20 minutes left. If we would stop right now, what I would say is that, okay, so the avos were very great people. Not only did they voluntarily do mitzvos, but they created a national identity and a culture of good character traits, being kind, being nice, being modest. But practically, what does that mean? Does that have any practical ramifications to justify the reverence and the importance that we attach to them? What does it exactly mean that we inherited character traits from them? So, as we'll see, I want to kind of examine it from three different approaches, from a legal approach, from a mystical approach, and from a sociological approach, which will connect back to Harlan, Kentucky. And all three of them are different sides of the same coin, different perspectives on the same idea, that the answer is yes. There is something very tangible that the avos contributed to our national identity and our national culture as Jews. If you look in source number 14, the Rambam paskins. He quotes the Gemara in Yevamos that we just read, and actually says that these midos are not just nice things to talk about in a drasha, but they actually have a practical implication. The Rambam says, "Kol mishpachos bechezkas ksheiros, umutzer lisa mehen lechadchila." Anybody who identifies as a Jew and just says they're Jewish and you don't know anything that would tarnish their reputation, you're allowed to marry into that family without any concern that they might not actually be Jewish. But afal pikein, and nevertheless, even though technically you're allowed to marry any person that you want that claims to be Jewish without raising any concerns, im ra'isa shtei mishpachos shemizgaro zo bazo tamid. If you see two families that are always continuously involved in a bitter fight, essentially a feud, like in Harlan, Kentucky, or if you see somebody that displays brazenness and cruelty, and just hates everyone else, and doesn't do kindness, one should be suspicious of their lineage. That the telltale signs of the holy Jewish nation are modesty, mercy, and kindness. And if a person or their entire family is completely absorbed with character traits that are in contradistinction to those character traits, then you need to give pause and check if they're really Jewish or not. Now, practically what one does is not a discussion for now. But what we see, at least, is that the Rambam took this very, very literally, that these are the signs of being Jewish. And if you so completely display midos that are antithetical to that, then one needs to give pause about that person's Jewish identity. And the question is, why is that true? Just because my great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, Avraham Avinu, was a kind person, might have been the kindest person, but why does that make me kind? And just on a much more smaller scale, we can think of many character traits of our parents or grandparents that we don't have, maybe for the good, maybe for the worse, maybe somewhere in between, maybe it's a mix, but we're not carbon copies of our ancestors. So what are unique about these three traits, which there's an expectation or taken for granted that there is almost this genetic transmission of these midos. And the mystical approach, if you will, is written by the Tanya in Perek Yud Ches in chapter 18. He says, yes, it's true. There is this almost genetic transmission of midos, that a spiritual DNA of the Jewish people that includes these midos because of the greatness of the Avos. We mentioned the Tanya a few weeks ago when we talked about the Avos, the forefathers, being a Merkava, essentially completely nullifying themselves to God and experience and having no other will other than to further the will of God. And so the Tanya develops this idea. And he says that this wasn't just something that was relegated to the Avos, but the because of their greatness, God gave a gift to them that their children would share in that conviction and share in that connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And he cites a very interesting historical phenomenon to prove his point. He says, Tzarech Leida, one needs to know, Ki af mi shedaito kitzara b'yidiyas Hashem, that even somebody that has, through no fault of their own, very little knowledge about God, ve'ein lo lev lahavin b'gdulas ein sof Baruch Hu, and doesn't really have the capabilities to understand Torah and the greatness of God, leholid mimena dachila urechima, to create a love and fear of God, afilu b'mochot utvunaso levad, even not on an emotional level, but even just on an intellectual level. Afal pike, nevertheless, karov adavar a love me'od, lishmor v'lasos kol mitzvah satorah. He says one's degree of mitzvah observance is not correlated to one's knowledge of God in the Torah. They're not inherently linked. You might not know a lot of Torah, but your fealty to God and Judaism will be unshakable. And he says, the reason why? Shehi Yerusha lanu me'avoseinu, the bolded part, he said, because it is an inheritance from our forefathers. Rach chetzarech lehakdim ulevaer, but we need to understand this. And he says, v'ha'inyan, and the reason is how this was an inheritance. Ki ha'avos hein hein ha'merkava, because the forefathers are a chariot for God, their sole will is to further the will of God. B'alkein, and because of that, zachu lahamshich nefesh ruach neshama libneim achareihem, they merited to transmit their into the souls of their descendants afterwards that same love for God. B'lachein afilu kal shebekalim, even the most lowly of Jew, uposhe Yisrael, and sinners, mosrim nafsham al kedushas Hashem al harov, by and large, even some of the most wicked Jews in history would give up their lives rather than deny God's existence. And they would undergo tremendous pain rather than deny God. And at the very end, he says, even if people are smart, let's say you have a very big Talmud Chacham in the Holocaust, many, many great Talmidei Chachamim and righteous people died and gave up their lives for Judaism. He says that if you would ask them, Ein misbonenem klal, what exactly went through their minds when they gave up their lives? He said it wasn't an intellectual decision. Ve'ein mosrim nafsham machmas das misbonenus b'Hashem klal. They don't give up their lives because they're philosophizing about God. Ela b'lishum das misbonenus, just like even the most simple or wicked person. It is without any introspection. It's something instinctual that Jews instinctively cannot deny God because we have this instinctive connection and love for God. And the role of a Jew is to try to fan the flame, that hidden flame, that pintaliyah, that Jewish spark inside, to reveal that hidden love to themselves and to the rest of the world and to God. But what the Tanya is saying is that because the Avos were a Merkava, because the forefathers were a chariot to God, they passed on to their descendants that same inbred in their spiritual DNA, that affinity to God, not on an intellectual or mitzvah obligation level, but on an emotional midos level. And so the language from the Tanya sounds like that this was something mystical that happened, that the Avos were really great, so God gave them a gift that part of their love and their connection to God was apportioned to every Jewish soul. So you could say that that's true, and I happen to do think that there is a lot of truth to that. But if you prefer a more rational approach, or even if you just merely want to sort of see this on a sociological level as well, as a mashal, as a parable, let us turn back to Harlan, Kentucky. The rationale that has been given by historians, anthropologists, and sociologists for why the people in Harlan, Kentucky, and the whole Cumberland Gap were so prone to feuds and family arguments and violent disputes is because of their ancestors. That's what they argued. They argued that their ancestors, unlike other parts of the Americas, where people came from agrarian communities or urban communities where cooperative work is needed, the people from the Cumberland Gap actually originally came from the Scottish Highlands and Ireland, where instead of being farmers or industry people or urban people, they were shepherds. And shepherds is not a cooperative field. Rather, each shepherd needs to fight for their own grazing territory. Honor is something that is, honor, family pride, and reputation is paramount. And that led to many lawless disputes. And when their ancestors moved to America, they moved to a very similar environment, a similar, very, very rural country environment. And they perpetuated those character traits. Now, one could make the argument and say, well, okay, that's just because they lived in an area that was also very similar to the Scottish Highlands or to Ireland and the grazing and their sheep herding ancestors. That there was a similar cultural environment that catalyzed and strengthened those character traits. But what two psychologists in the 90s found is that that's not really the case, and that they actually persist even when the environment is changed. They did a study in the University of Michigan of a group of students coming from the north and a group of students coming from the south, not in Harlan County, Kentucky, but actually in a very urban environment in Atlanta, Georgia. That was where some people were from. And the test that they gave was they would have people walk down a hallway. And some of the people would just walk through and they would meet these two psychologists. They would give a saliva sample. They would shake hands and they would answer a questionnaire about certain behavioral questions. That was the control group. The experimental group, in addition to doing all of that, they were verbally accosted on the way by somebody blocking their path. He would mutter an insult or mutter a curse. And then they would enter the psychologist's office. And what the psychologist measured was the firmness of the handshake, the level of cortisol in their saliva, which signifies the adrenal gland in terms of the fight or flight. Basically, they were trying to measure how angry these people got. And the question that they asked them, the behavioral question that they asked them was, imagine there are two people, their name are Jill and Steve. And so they were at a party, and about 20 minutes into the party, Steve noticed that his fiance Jill was very bothered. And so what's wrong, asked Steve. So Jill replied, it's Larry. I mean, he knows that you and I are engaged, but he's already made two passes at me tonight. Jill walked back into the crowd and Steve decided to keep his eye on Larry. Sure enough, within 5 minutes, Larry was reaching over and trying to kiss Jill. And the question that they asked both these Northern and Southern students was, what would you do? Or what do you think Larry should do? And so the results were very telling. Most of the Northern people essentially laughed off the prompt. They didn't think it was such a big deal. Their handshakes were unchanged. The cortisol level actually went down in their saliva, indicating that they were actually trying to subconsciously diffuse their own anger. But the people that came from the Southern communities, they were angry. Their handshakes were very firm. Their level of cortisol jumped. And their answers were that Larry should fight for his honor and stuff like that. And what the psychologist argued is that both groups of people, both the Northern and the Southern people, they both came from very similar immediate environments. They both came from urban backgrounds, cooperative societies. None of them came from anything that had an analog to Harlan, Kentucky, or the Scottish or Irish Highlands. And nevertheless, the cultural legacies that were passed down were so powerful that it lived on even a totally different environment, even in the University of Michigan. And what they were arguing is that because whatever values and cultures were so strong to their ancestors, they managed to pass them down consciously and unconsciously for generations, even when the environments totally changed. And so I just to end off, there's I found this study, I found the essay about Harlan, Kentucky in a book, some of you might know it, it's called Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell, who writes, he writes a lot of nonfiction pieces, and this book was about individual and cultural outliers and what the forces are that influence certain outcomes. And his main thesis is in source number 16, that cultural legacies are powerful forces. They have deep roots and long lives. They persist generation after generation, virtually intact, even as the economic and social demographic conditions that spawned them have vanished. And they play such a role in directing attitudes and behavior that we cannot make sense of our world without them. And if you want a sociological explanation, or at least a mushel for perhaps the more mystical explanation of how the Avos were able to pass on these character traits to the Jewish people, I think that this serves as a very good example, that the midos of chesed, of kindness, of rachmanim, of mercy, and of baishanim, and a lack of brazenness, of modesty, were so central to what Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah stood for, that both on a conscious but on an unconscious level, they were able to transmit that and create a national identity, a permanent, eternal national identity founded on those values, even before the Torah was given, that actually complemented the Torah and worked in synergy with the Torah to build the Jewish nation and identity that we have today. And so when we invoke the merit and our affiliation and our connection to the forefathers specifically, and not merely other righteous people before Matan Torah like Noach or Shem or Aver, the reason is not because they were particularly more righteous or not, but rather because of their profound connection to God, they managed to transmit a holistic set of character traits to their descendants that was so powerful and so important that it managed to persist throughout the end of time, obviously with the help of God and with the Havtacha, with the promise of God. And so that's sort of the what. That is sort of the what we are thankful and what we connect to the Avos for. Hopefully what we'll discuss next week is, okay, so we're very happy about the fact that the Avos passed on these character traits for us. But the question is, well, why is that important? And, you know, why do we care about that? You know, it's very nice to be kind. It's very nice to be merciful. It's very nice to be modest. But what does that do for us vis-a-vis our Judaism and not just as our makeup as part of human beings? So hopefully we'll be able to learn about that next time. Thank you all for joining. It was a pleasure learning with you all. And if you have any questions or comments, you can use the chat or you can unmute and please share. Okay. Well, it was wonderful learning with you all. I'm going to stop the recording and looking
for. Hello. One quick question.
Sure. Yeah.
Or actually, a statement. I thought it was fantastic and beautiful, and it does make me feel proud to be a Jew. That's it.
Yeah, it really does. Well, thank you all, and looking forward to seeing you all next week. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Stay healthy, stay safe.
Thank you, Steve.